Welcome to the BVL Digital Podcast. I'm your host, Boris Felgendreher, and today we're going to talk about how to supercharge your career in global supply chain and logistics. That's right. I think we picked a really good guest for this one. His name is Radu Palamario, and he is a top-tier headhunter for global supply chain and logistics talent. In that role, he has firsthand experience with what companies are actually looking for when they're trying to recruit top talent to run their global supply chain or logistics operations. And what I've tried to do here with Radu is to package up that experience into some tangible, practical advice that you can use to take your supply chain and logistics career to the next level. Whether you're just getting started or whether you're just one more step from that chief supply chain officer role, it doesn't matter. I think Radu's advice is applicable across the board. Okay, without further ado, here comes Radu Palamario from Alcott Global in Singapore. Happy listening. Radu, welcome to the BVL Digital Podcast.
My pleasure, Boris. Thanks for having me.
Radu, I gave the audience a tiny inside window into your background and career, but it's never the same as hearing it from your own voice. What's your background? Radu Palamario. First of all, the name strikes me as exotic. What's your background and how did you end up as a headhunter in the supply chain logistics space in Singapore, out of all places?
Yes, sure, with pleasure. So, not sure how exotic I am, given that that BVL and most of your listeners are from Germany. So, I'm originally from Romania, from Eastern Europe, and I graduated there. And immediately after graduation, which was about 12 years ago, I somehow got this idea that I wanted to work in Asia. And don't ask me why I got this idea, because I kind of forgotten. But I was very, very intent on doing that. And it happened for me. I got a one-year internship at that point in time in Singapore for a management consulting firm. Came here, stayed for 1 year, then went back to Romania, got married, and we decided to take a backpacking tour together with my wife. In Southeast Asia, so we spent about six months in Southeast Asia backpacking, which was one of the most amazing life experiences, and I would thoroughly recommend it to everybody because it kind of brings that baggage of exposure that you would otherwise find hard to get. And after that, we said, look, what do we do? Do we go back to Europe? Germany was actually one of the options as well, France and a few other places, obviously Romania. But then we said, no, let's stay in Singapore. And here we are, 12 years later, we are still here. 2 kids later, we're still here, but also on the professional side. It kind of weaved quite nicely because I did a lot of work when it comes to management consulting, and it happened to be in supply chain. And about 7-8 years ago, I made the transition towards recruitment, executive search, headhunting, specifically in supply chain, manufacturing, logistics. And ever since, I've gotten quite passionate and excited about it. We also have our own podcast, Leaders in Supply Chain, where we try also to create content and bring the industry together. And obviously, dealing with people, the more people you know, the more you find out about the industry, and it's a consistent learning journey. So it keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, and just going back to your thought of coming back or moving to Germany. When I look outside now, it's a early February, grainy, 10-degree rainy day outside, and you're what, at 32 degrees year-round in Singapore? I think you made the right call.
Yeah, I'm definitely not missing winter. Let's put it this way. I'm not missing winter time in Europe. I do miss the snow. That's fantastic, and going skiing and all of that, but not the gray weather. So for that, definitely it's good to be in the tropics.
Yeah. So an interesting that you ended up in supply chain and logistics. You know, from what I've noticed is, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been this constant discussion around supply chain management and logistics as being either completely unsexy or totally sexy or becoming more sexy. This is sort of the never-ending story. Where do you land on that? Is it really true that supply chain management has become sexier over the years? Is that your experience as well?
Yes and no. So I would say that over the years that I've been at least exposed to it, what has happened specifically in the last 7 to 8 years, there's been a big rise of e-commerce. Mm-hmm. As we know, we have the Amazons of the world and Alibaba and whatnot. So that has added a flavor of things that are a bit more exciting, a bit sexier. And I would put that into the supply chain arena as well, even if it is e-commerce. At the same time, especially in the last 2, 3, 4 years, we've had Industry 4.0 initiatives ramping up all over the world. And I think there's still a long way to go. But we've had things like Internet of Things, big data, 3D printing, robotics, artificial intelligence, and a number of other things that have really sparked a lot of interest and developments in the field of supply chain, manufacturing, logistics. So I think this together have made the industry more interesting. And at the same time, I would say there's a long way to go to actually make it sexy, right? Because when you compare it to the likes of Google or Facebook or other tech companies, I don't think we are yet there. And at the same time, some progress has been made. So I think it also boils down to, again, technology and the way it is shaping and developing the industry and the function in the recent developments and examples. And at the same time, there's still quite a bit of things to be done more by the industry to make sure that we attract especially the young generation to it.
And a lot has been said also about the arrival of supply chain management in the executive suite, right? So the chief supply chain officer and the rise of that job. Is that really reality? Has that really panned out as it had been predicted, 5 years ago when that name first came up and that was all the rage that all of a sudden supply chain management is showing up in the executive suite? Has that really followed through? Has that really materialized?
I would say it's happening. It's in the process of happening. It's not yet as prevalent as I don't know, having a CFO, for example, right? I don't think not all organizations have a chief supply chain officer, but all of them have a chief financial officer. So it's not yet there, but it's definitely on the way to getting there. And perhaps the number one reason is market, and the market from a sense of you can copy a lot of things. There's very few things actually that you cannot copy in today's world, right? If we talk about, you know, Samsung or Apple or other big brands, whenever they launch a new phone or a new product, whatever it may be, the competition typically has literally, it's called a war room. Some of them call it actually a war room, where they take the product and they disassemble it. And within 2, 3 weeks, they can put together a similar product. Now, what most companies and in most industries cannot do, even if they're very good at copying or pretty much creating and manufacturing a similar product, they're not as good in terms of delivering it to the market. And that's where the supply chain function comes into play. And hence the rise of the role and hence the importance of the role as chief supply chain officer that we have seen in the last 5 years. So definitely more and more companies, especially the Fortune 500, maybe Fortune 1000, have recognized and are recognizing the importance. And you can find in most boards, especially on the manufacturing companies specifically, you will find the chief supply chain officer role. At the same time, you know, the world is not limited only to the Fortune 500 companies. So right. There's still a lot of others that may not have the same importance yet. But I think we are getting there slowly but surely, driven again by this reality that you can copy many things, you can copy many products, but you cannot copy a whole supply chain. You cannot copy a network. You cannot copy the distributors. You cannot copy the go-to-market if that is a robust ecosystem.
Mm. And has the supply chain also become a pathway in terms of a career now to the CEO spot? I know there's a couple of examples, right? Let's take Tim Cook from Apple, for example, right? He came from the manufacturing and the supply chain side, made it to the CEO post. Any other examples that come to mind in terms of the supply chain being a career path into the CEO function?
For sure. There's many others. And we're going to see this more and more as well. So I think another prominent example is Mary Barra, who's the CEO of General Motors. And she used to be for many years from a supply chain and operations and manufacturing side. Another good example, also a woman as well, which is great for diversity, is Annette Clayton, who used to be the chief supply chain officer
Schneider.
Of Schneider Electric. Yeah. Yes, and now she's the CEO of Schneider Electric for North America. So I think there's a few. And kind of back to the other question, the more we're going to see the chief supply chain officer on the board, the more this type of success stories will come through. So I think we're just at the beginning. It is definitely a path to the CEO position more and more. And it again boils down to also the model of the company and to the importance or not, or the perceived importance or not of the supply chain, right? Because the more the C-suite sees that as important, the CEO sees it as important, the more likely that eventually the CSCO will become CEO. And of course, not all companies, nevertheless, are on the same path. So sometimes, in a lot of them, still the CFO or the head of sales or head of commercial tends to have a higher influence. So I guess overall, if I'm to summarize, yes, we see more, and at the same time, it's a journey.
Yeah, and what would you describe as a typical profile of a chief supply chain officer? So what sort of experience or skill set does it take to make it into that role today, 2020? And has that changed over time?
I guess if there's one thing that's a constant in the world is change, and forever, this is the only constant, really, that things do change. So I would say that now more than ever, it's important to have a diverse background. So what do I mean by that? And also let me qualify a little bit. I'm not sure there is one type of background that fits all chief supply chain officers. But I do believe there are certain characteristics that make it as a higher probability for the person to become and be a very good chief supply chain officer. So one of those characteristics would be exposure to the full spectrum of the four key pillars, right, of supply chain, which is pretty much plan, source, make, deliver. So it's people that have had the exposure over their careers from a planning perspective, sourcing and procurement perspective, making manufacturing perspective, and delivering logistics perspective, typically have that fundamentals and know how the entire ecosystem works to be able to put it all together, pieces all together, and have that strategic view that is a must for a chief supply chain officer. Now, this is more or less a fundamental. If you want, it's a hygiene factor. On top of this, I would say a good chief supply chain officer needs to have had a lot of international exposure. So some of them, and most of them, if not all of them, would have worked at least in two continents, if not more. I think you had Sami Nafak on your podcast, who is the CEO of Arla Foods. And he's been having multiple assignments. So he's worked in Africa, Europe, Eastern Europe as well, Asia, North America. So that type of international exposure is a must in an organization that wants itself to be global, because there's no other way to be a good chief supply chain officer of a global organization. So I would say that fundamentally is also key to a good profile. And also, typically people that make it to that level come from a strong either consulting background, so they've had a stint in their careers where they were either in an external consulting role. So I'm not necessarily talking about McKinsey or Bain or the big consulting companies, but something like that, where they were exposed to many different operating models and many different business models, because that gives you and broadens your mindset. Or they could have been an internal consulting. So one of my friends, he had kind of did both. So he's the chief supply chain officer of Roche Pharmaceuticals, Matthew Winterman. So he was both a consultant before this. He was in GSK before Roche. So he was an internal consultant in GSK's supply chain for some years, coming up with improvements all throughout their global supply chain. And before that, he was also an external consultant as part of a different organization. So that usually gives a good blend and openness of mindset in terms of knowing many different business models, project models, country models, and knowing how to extrapolate and knowing how to take strategic decisions. So I would say that's another characteristic that I can see usually helps a lot to make it to a chief supply chain officer position. And then, of course, you have influencing skills, leadership skills, ability to navigate the organization, ability to be a business partner to the organization. All of that, of course, come with the position, and you can only achieve that by having a multitude of different leadership roles within the company and building strong relations.
Mm. How old is your typical CSCO?
Again, it probably depends also on a number of aspects, size of the organization, and all of that. But if I'm to give a range, I guess it's probably the youngest one that I would know is somewhere in the range of 40 to 45, and you know, then all the way to, you know, all the way to whatever age you would think of. But we've seen some, you know, we've seen some very young, aggressive, go-getter type of profiles that have made it very far in the organization. Usually, again, they would have had quite a few projects under their belts in which they would have proven to be able to transform. Usually the term is digital transformation, right? The buzzword. A few digital transformation projects within supply chains of companies that helps a lot in terms of getting you enough exposure and visibility to make it to that level. And then you can also turbocharge and fast charge your career.
Since we were talking about ranges earlier, what's your what's a range of salaries that are being paid at that level?
And the million-dollar question that everybody wants to know. Right? So,
of course.
I would.
That's
say
the only reason we're having the podcast, by the way.
Yeah,
we just wanted
exactly.
to get to that question.
It's clear. I would say that. It greatly matters the size, obviously the size, the profitability, and the type of industry that the company is in, because it's one thing to be a chief supply chain officer in a luxury goods versus to be in a similar position maybe into a much more volume based type of an industry.
Right.
But if we are talking for companies that are what you would rank as Fortune 500 companies, and within a global scope, then typically anything between 400k, 450k euros to be honest, the sky is the limit, so it can be quite significant.
On the Gartner top 25 list with your supply chain, you're towards the top end.
Yes, exactly. So, and I better not comment because then I might get myself into trouble but obviously there's a lot of listed companies, and then you can check for yourselves how much some of the executive members are making. I don't need to tell you. Like in Apple, I think you can actually see what's the salaries of the different executives in Apple and so on. And then on top of that, usually there's quite significant bonuses that are tied up to the company performance. So these are, again, rough ranges.
Any interesting, exciting, exotic perks that you've come across that companies are using at that level to get people interested to join, to attract talent?
Probably the most common one is stock options for listed companies. So for listed companies, it's fairly common to attract top talent by giving stock options and by giving that type of benefits on top of the bonus and on top of the package. And then if it is a private equity driven deal, because sometimes if you're familiar, private equity acquires a company and then puts in an executive leadership team to transform and maximize the returns on that particular company, then usually the executive team, including the chief supply chain officer, would have a target bonus of such, depending on how fast they can reach the agreed KPIs that they have set up with the PE. But I would say it's usually very much linked to the financial returns of the company, whether it is through shares or through KPIs or through different various other ways. Now, if you are to talk about, so this is more financial. Now, exotic perks, you know, one of my friends just got a role in Canada, and one of the perks was that they gave him a house with a heated paveway, so he wouldn't have to shovel the snow in front of his house. So that's fairly specific, and you know, maybe exotic is not the right word, but it's fairly unusual. Let's call it like this.
Yeah.
Because exotic and Canada, they might be offended if we call them exotic, but it's unusual. They also looked after his dog. He had a dog, and they had to transport him, across from Asia to Canada. So they gave the dog was very well pampered. It's like a first class type of situation. So, you know, you can say they really went down the extra mile to make sure that he was very happy to join them.
Yeah, interesting. And if you look at those compensation packages, how do they compare to other functions and roles? How do they compare to marketing? How do they compare to finance? Is it up there, or is it still somewhat behind? Where does executive compensation stand supply chain versus other functions?
If the company is serious and if it is serious about the role of supply chain, and if indeed the supply chain is within the board, board leadership is on the board and is on the board, the company board leadership, by right in general in companies, there should not be significant differences from a chief supply chain officer to a head of commercial to a CFO to a, you know, whatever else might be that sits on the board. By right. Now, by left, life is never 100% fair. If anything, probably life is less fair than actually fair. So there's always going to be some differences. Yeah, I don't have enough data or statistic information to say, look, it's always that sales gets more than supply chain or the other way around. I would just say that if indeed, you know, it's a role within the board, then it should by right be compensated fairly similar to the other positions. Now, if it is not, then obviously there would be a difference.
And just to kind of tease out the difference again between logistics or careers in global logistics versus careers in global supply chain, are there any major differences there, or did everything you've mentioned so far pretty much apply to both worlds?
Now, if you mean by, actually wanted to clarify, because careers in logistics to me, it means careers in the logistics industry, which is fairly focused on the 3PL as a core, right? So mm-hmm. That's what you mean by careers in logistics, right?
Correct, yes. Yeah.
And strictly from a terminology perspective, obviously logistics as a function is just a sub function of the supply chain function, which has the other three plan, right. Source, and make, right? So strictly from a career in logistics perspective, I think most of the things kind of are similar, right? So it's still good if you had international assignments. And actually, if anything, international logistics companies are very good at moving people around the world, or used to be very good. Now it's slowing down a little bit, but I think they're still among the industries where you can get exposure to a lot of different countries. They still move you around a lot if you're open to that. So I think that fundamentally is still very important. Where I would add the difference between having a strong career in SCM, supply chain management, versus having a strong career within the logistics 3PL industry, of course, if you want to become a CEO in a global logistics company, you definitely need to come from a P&L management perspective, right? So at some point, you know, you would have gone through air freight, ocean freight, whatever it might have been, right? Contract logistics, warehousing. But at some point, you need to make the transition to owning the P&L of a country or of a, you know, subsector or of a region, and then so on and so forth, right? So that's the difference between, in some ways, that can be a difference. Usually in the supply chain function in a company, there's also P&Ls, but it's slightly differently measured, right? So I would say if you want to become a CEO in a logistics company, you definitely need to be very strong in sales and marketing and hold the P&L on top of you holding an international career as well.
And if you could boil it down to pieces of advice that people may have, if they are, let's say, in a mid-level career, mid-level management with high aspirations to make it to the top, what are some pieces of advice you would give to these people? How do you make it different? How do you turbocharge your career if you're in the middle?
If I am to boil down to the number one that I would choose is get top mentors. I think that would be my number one most important thing to do.
Mentors, okay. Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. So one of our clients is the CEO for a cluster in Asia, and basically he was sharing with me that a couple of years ago he was at a conference and he said, look, I'm open to mentor. I'm always mentoring some people in my organization. And then one of the people within the room lifted his hand and said, hey, can you also be my mentor? And he was not from that organization, but my client said, okay, no problem, I will mentor you. Long story short, they started the mentorship relationship, and a couple of years later, that gentleman that was the mentee developed a lot because he learned a lot from the CEO. And also the CEO happened to have a senior job within his company, and he hired him. Now, not everybody will have the same trajectory, but the point of the story is a mentor can help you a lot in terms of fast-tracking your learning, fast-tracking your networking, understanding how to navigate organizations, and give you great advice. So I would say that's number one for me as a way of turbocharging your career. And of course, you can have several mentors. You don't have to have only one. Mm-hmm. Now, another very important point is what we've kind of discussed already, so I won't dwell too much into it. It would be have international assignments. expose yourself. There's no way in which somebody can make it to a global position unless they've worked in at least two continents, I would say, ideally more. I would say one of those two continents should be Asia, because I'm biased, I live in Asia, but look, Asia is the present and is the future. I mean, it's the largest economy in the world as a block is Asia. For the foreseeable future, it's going to be Asia. So I would say I would strongly recommend people have an international exposure so they know what is going on. And on top of Asia, I would recommend strongly another emerging markets if you can. Africa, Central America, South America, something like that would be fantastic. So that international exposure is a must, as far as I'm concerned. And then the second piece, which also we've discussed a little bit, move across functions, have a depth of experience, be that consultant, the internal consultant, external consultant, have exposure to many different things. Don't just be the specialist in procurement. Nothing wrong with that if you want to become the specialist in procurement. I'm just taking it as an example, and I hope I didn't offend any procurement specialists. But what I'm saying is, if you want to move into an executive leadership position down the line, then you need to have a breadth of, you know, you need to have a breadth of experience in different areas of the business. Another thing that I would recommend people to do would be to invest in their personal brand. What do I mean by that? So nowadays we have LinkedIn, all of us, we have LinkedIn, and you know, there's ways in which you can share information, you can interact with other people, you can make friends, make connections on LinkedIn. That's a social way to do it. And obviously it increases your brand professionally and personally. Within your company, you should increase your brand by networking, making relationships, making friends, and getting to know as many people as you can. And thirdly, by going to conferences, going to events, speaking if you can. All of this builds your personal brand, and that can be an invaluable asset in terms of turbocharging your career. So these four: get top mentors, get international assignments, move across different functions and projects, and invest in your personal brand.
Yeah, let's double click on the personal brand a little bit later. One thing I'm interested to find out is the role of recruiters and headhunters, and how important it is, if at all, to build relationships with those folks early on.
It's vital. It's very important. I mean, what can I say? I'm a recruiter myself, so I could. I would be shooting myself in the foot. Would I say anything else?
Yeah, but I mean, are you sitting there waiting for a recruiter to show up and ping you, or are you proactively, you know, building relationships before it's actually time that you need the headhunter and we need the recruiter? That's what I meant, like by building relationships.
Absolutely. And it is a very good question. I was joking a little bit. Yes. and it should be, to my mind, it should be a proactive approach. So like most things in life, right, it's better that you are working and having the relationships before you need the relationship, right? It's not when you need it that all of a sudden, you know, everybody will jump on you. So I would argue that it is a good thing. I mean, at the end of the day, obviously there's good headhunters, there's bad headhunters. I mean, I'm not here to discuss, you know, from that perspective. But I would say that good headhunters can be extremely beneficial to somebody's career, because they have on their radar opportunities that otherwise you are unlikely to get to or find out. Now, again, it depends on the step of your career, because if you're mid-level, then it might take a bit of time before you make it to the C-suite. But still, I would say that it's never too early, right? Because you can still build relationship with people, and maybe, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line, you end up getting a role through them. I mean, I place people after knowing them for 5 years sometimes. So you never really know. And it's not only about whether they have a job for you or not. It's also about the relationship, the industry information sharing that you can get from them, right? So I would see it as such. I would see it as, you know, the good headhunters, again, are the ones that would actually know very well. They can be very good mentors as well. They know, they've seen a lot of people go up in their careers and do well, so they can even advise quite well in terms of what needs to be done. They would know where the industry is going, what type of skill sets are needed, what type of soft and hard skills are needed. So I would say overall, I would recommend, especially when you see somebody is very well connected within the ecosystem, try to make friends or build a relationship with them.
Yeah, and what would you say, what's the percentage of these high-level jobs that get filled by the help of recruiters as opposed to any other means? It's probably pretty high, right? The percentage of
it's fairly high. Yes, I mean, if you think about it, right? I mean, we've all, and myself, I've been part of big organizations. You might have worked for big organizations, Boris, and you know, some of our listeners are working for big organizations. Now, if you're looking for a chief supply chain officer, obviously you can look internally, and you should look internally in an organization. And if you have a healthy pipeline, by right, you should have one or two options internally as well, right? In terms of your leadership development, you should have had some successor plan. But at the same time, you typically want to make sure that you're getting the best of the best. So if you want to make sure of that, how are you going to do that? Are you going to ask your HR to scout the market? Not really, right? Because, I mean, if your HR calls the chief supply chain officer of the competitor, it's unlikely that that person would pick up the phone, right? It's a little bit weird. So most of the time, these things go through a headhunter that would map the market, would give a fairly good comparison, and then it's up to the company to decide whether it's internal, external, whatever the choice may be. But most cases, I would say, I mean, I don't have an exact percentage, but I would say in quite a lot of cases, this goes through a headhunter.
And I guess one way to show up on the radar of good headhunters is by building, as you call it, building your personal brand. What are the different avenues that people can take? So we talked about, we touched on LinkedIn, speaking, and sort of a general social media presence. Let's pick one after the other. Let's talk about speaking engagements first. How important is that? How important is it for a supply chain director or VP or even manager to show up on the speaking circuit to speak about their supply chain capabilities of the company?
Yeah, excellent question. I'll just backtrack a little bit in terms of the importance of brand, right? So if I wanted actually to ask a rhetorical question, if you think about it, who gets the jobs ultimately, whether it's a job and a promotion internally, whether it's a job that is open for candidates externally, the person that has the best brand typically has a better chance, don't they? Internally, usually, I mean, if it's a couple of people applying for the same job within the same company, it's usually the person who has a good brand, best connections, of course, who has done the best work. But sometimes best work is questionable, right? I mean, it's not always an objective way of measuring what is best work. Typically, we are human beings. It's typically subjective. And that subjectivity boils down to two things: the brand of the person and the relationships that that person has built within the organization. And sometimes these things are very much interconnected, actually. So I cannot stress enough how important it is. And then the kind of topics of, you know, LinkedIn versus speaking at conferences, it's not even versus, because if you have a strong social media, if you have a strong LinkedIn presence and you've built your relationship, it's likely that you're going to be asked to speak at conferences. I mean, you know, obviously, let's say even in today's conversation that we're having, you know, we connected via LinkedIn, you know, we had a good relationship, and now here am I being a guest on your podcast. So this kind of things happen, right? If we put out content, we put our thoughts out there, and then people resonate with it, there's more likelihood that we're going to be invited also to speak at conferences. And if you get to speak at conferences, obviously you're going to be seen as a thought leader in a particular industry. You're going to connect to a lot more people that are listening to you in the audience. And over time, that builds up so much capital in terms of your image and brand that can only help you in your career.
Let's talk about LinkedIn. And I think there's still a fair amount of people out there that associate LinkedIn with the place where you post your online resume, right? And they haven't really caught on to the transition of LinkedIn to a platform where you actually can build your personal brand through content and thought leadership and engaging with other people. I know you're a master at LinkedIn. When I look what you're doing there and your connections and the sort of engagement you get from your post, you're at the top of your game. Any advice for people who really have been living behind a rock and think that LinkedIn is still the place that you occasionally visit when it's time to look for a job or when it's time to update your resume?
A lot of advice, and I'm with you. I think most people are not utilizing LinkedIn to the full potential of what LinkedIn has to offer. A lot of people and a lot of the users are indeed only going there when they're looking for a job. And I think that's kind of back to our point with, should you be building relationships with headhunters or kind of just go to them when you need them? It's in many ways similar. You go on LinkedIn and build a brand not when you need a job. Ideally, you should have the brand when you need a job because it's easier. you will get many, many different different offers if you have built yourself a strong brand. So I would say that LinkedIn is the number one, the platform for people to build their brands from a professional perspective, whether they're looking for a job or not, is the number one social platform to engage with other thought leaders, other influencers within their industry. It's a great place to learn. I mean, it's just fantastic, the amount of content and the quality of content given the algorithm on LinkedIn, because they feed you content based on what you care about, based on also what other people think is good. So, and it's worth reading, right? So that's extremely valuable as well. So I would say all in all, it's an invaluable source. I mean, obviously I'm in recruitment and headhunting. For me, it's the number one place to find candidates as well. But I think anybody should find a lot of good ways to use it. So I would encourage and urge people to be there and to share, and also to put their energy into building that brand by sharing, by engaging, by putting their thoughts out there, and not only doing that when they're looking for a job.
Yeah, any tangible advice, any tangible tips of what to do, what not to do, what works well? Because I see a lot of people struggling with this link sharing, right? I mean, there's a number of tools available now that have become popular a few years ago where, you know, corporate marketing department would initiate a new tool that makes it super easy to tee up links to interesting posts for employees to share, only to find out there's no interest, there's no engagement when you share links constantly on LinkedIn. And I know there's something related to the algorithm of LinkedIn not wanting people to move away from the platform, right? So they kind of discourage spread of posts that only have a link in them, because they want to keep people on the platform and don't want to point people away when they have link. Is that your experience as well? I see that some people that I know, that's their entire game, is posting links to external article that they find, and they don't see a lot of traction. What should people do instead?
I was reading somewhere a statistic that about 90%, 90, of people that are on LinkedIn are ghosts, as in they just are there sometimes. Sometimes some of them are actually there every day, but they just read and they just don't click on anything. You wouldn't know that they exist. They don't like your stuff, they don't comment on your stuff. They are just ghosts. About, and don't quote my percentages, I might have gotten it plus minus, but about
ballpark
6 to 8% are also contributing, in a sense of, you know, they like, they comment, they engage, every so often they share something. And only about 2%, 2-3% are the ones that are actively sharing and creating content. Now, whether it is, you know, sharing links, whether it is video, whether it is audio, it's video, and it's, you know, you have also the slides that you can put out, you have the LinkedIn articles that you can write, and obviously you can post just in plain post something. So it's a really small number, 2-3%. So I would say link sharing in and by itself is not a bad thing, because it still puts you within those 2-4% of people that actually do something. Mm-hmm. However, right, to your point, LinkedIn and all other platforms, right, that people might use for their personal life, Instagram or Facebook or whatever else it may be, no platform encourages you to share a link, because they don't want you to leave the platform, right? So it's the same with Facebook. If you post a link on Facebook, they won't give that link much visibility. It's the same for LinkedIn. So when you share a link, it's much less visibility than, for example, if you just directly write your story in a post and just post it. So if you write plain text on your LinkedIn, that will have 10 times to 100 times more visibility than if you share a link. Yeah. Very 101 hack that I will give everybody. If you really like that link and want to share it, just make an intro to that link, say, whatever it may be. I posted recently, global supply chains are likely to be very disrupted because of the coronavirus in China. These are some interesting data, which I just quoted some data, right, in terms of the number of tourists that are being affected. Link in the first comment. I posted that, and then in the first comment, I included the link to the newspaper that talked more. So in this way, I didn't put the link in the original post. I put it in the comment, and I maximized the visibility of the post. So it's an easy way to do it, do around it. I would say most of these things, if you actually are passionate and willing to put effort into building your own brand, you would figure out in terms of LinkedIn. So link sharing is a good start. You're still within that 2-4% of people that are actually doing something. So do it. But then there's a lot more things that you can do, you know, from sharing your, from sharing your videos, maybe you take a video of yourself, to sharing, I saw procurement consulting that he was sharing different thoughts that he had in terms of how to do digital procurement, global procurement, and so on and so forth, different tips that he would share every week. There's different people that are comfortable with different things. But I would say at the minimum, everybody can share something that they find insightful about the industry, about their topic, about what they're interested in. And you can engage with posts. If, let's say, you really don't want to post anything of your own or you don't feel comfortable to create content, you can still post and engage with other people's content, right? You have your influencer in your industry, you can share directly on that person's, and it might be a CEO. Sometimes you can interact with CEOs that way, right? You can engage with their content and then basically put a note there in a genuine way. I mean, don't just do it for the sake of being recognized, because people can sense it when you're being fake. Yeah. And that in itself is also a good thing to help your brand and help your connections on the long run.
Yeah. What's a good rule of thumb for how often you should be posting and sharing? Because obviously there's a time constraint, right? People have jobs to do, and they should be spending all of their time on LinkedIn. They should
minimize. And also, sometimes genuinely, I have heard this question, you know, Radu, if I post too often, won't my boss think that I'm, wasting my time and not having enough to do in my job? So there's obviously there's common sense things, and there's different companies out there. Some are more appreciative of LinkedIn and encouraging of that. Some are less. I don't know if there is one rule that fits all. I mean, for example, for myself, I post daily, but then again, I'm really, LinkedIn is the way in which we build communities, we build relationships, we gain clients. It serves a lot of different purposes for us. I would say if you're an executive and again your time is more or less limited, or if you're in mid management, I would say 2 to 3 times a week can be a great way to do it, right? If you have that time. And sometimes, weekend can be a good time as well, because a lot of people are on LinkedIn in the weekend, even if you may not think they are, but they are, because that's when they have time. So again, zero is great. One is greater than zero. I like that saying. One is greater than zero, right? So if you post something, it's better than not doing anything. If you post several times, it's better than posting once. Now, don't post pictures of your cats and dogs. There's also a wrong way to do it, right? Because if you start thinking that LinkedIn is Facebook, that will damage your brand rather than help your brand.
Sure. Yeah.
But all this, it's kind of fall in the realm of try and error and common sense at some point.
Yeah, experimenting, I guess, comes into play, right? See what fits your style and what comes naturally to you and what you get traction with. And don't be afraid to experiment with the stuff, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Going back to that conversation that you alluded to earlier, which is the internal conversation that you have inside your team with your boss, maybe, about you building your personal brand versus building the supply chain capabilities brand of your company, if you know what I mean. Like there's a value to humanizing the corporate brand, but it oftentimes gets misunderstood as someone just trying to promote his own brand. How do you navigate that space if you're an employee trying to do more on the personal branding front and want to speak at conference about your supply chain capabilities? And two, if you're a manager, how do you encourage your team or are comfortable with your team being out there, putting themselves out there and promoting the supply chain capabilities of your corporate brand? How do you navigate that space?
It's a great question, and to be fair, again, it greatly depends on the organization that you're part of. Short answer to how do you navigate your own brand versus your company's brand? Not sure that there is a clear way around that, because ultimately people will put the two together, right? I mean, if you think of Satya Nadella from Microsoft, he's the CEO of Microsoft, and that's it. I mean, nothing that he can post online. Can he say that he's doing totally disconnected from his capacity as CEO of Microsoft? So at some point, just as an example, but at some point, our personal brands and our professional brands are very, very similarly interconnected, at least on LinkedIn. So that's why I'm saying that it will depend greatly also on what is the company framework, because some companies may encourage employees to do it, some may not. But I mean, I don't think any company would ban employees from posting things on social media within reason, right? So again, if you're passionate, if you're a supply chain professional and you're passionate about Industry 4.0 or different initiatives there, and you're posting about that because you read an article, you read a report, or you tried something, you might not be able to say, hey, within my company, we tested X, Y, Z, and go specific and give the details. That you might not be able to do. But you know, you can post things that are related that may not, you know, obviously breach any confidentiality, and ask for people's opinion. So that you can do. So I'm saying, you know, it's a little bit, you got to be cognizant of both. I would say if you're not sure, of course, you know, again, common sense is you should check within your framework of your organization and your boss and all of that, right? I mean, nobody's here to say that you should share confidential case studies and information. But most people, my impression is most people, Boris, overthink in a big, big way. Like, There's a massive amount of overthinking about, oh, but what if my, you know, what will my boss say? Or, oh, what if I share something that is, and people think I'm silly? Or, oh, you know, I mean, it's just so much overthinking that, like, most things are not that big a drama. And actually, they can add value. And I had this journey myself where I was like, maybe this is not worth sharing. And in recent times, I've just gotten to the conclusion that, look, do I think this could help somebody? One person.
Yeah.
So I have a very low bar. So if my answer is yes, it could help one person, then I mean, again, you know, there's a lot of different things that you can share. Obviously, it has to go within what we do. It has to fit some common sense thing, right? It has to fit my area of expertise and what I'm passionate about. Sure. But if it's going to help somebody, post it, right?
What's been your most successful post so far? Do you recall?
We've had a few. I mean, success. If you measure success by the number of, you know, by the number of views and likes,
and also engagement and comments. I mean, engagement and comments are important too, right?
By far, the best ones were the ones that came from a very authentic story sharing. So I shared something on a CEO leaving an organization, and basically he left that organization after 25 years, and you know, people were crying and coming to him and saying thank you and all of that. And he was like, "Wow, Radu, I was shocked because, you know, I was CEO for 7 years and nobody said thank you to me when I was the CEO. But then when I left, you know, everybody was crying in my office," and which is a common thing because, you know, also there is the loneliness of being a CEO, and people don't want to, for good reason sometimes, they don't want to be seen as, you know, being either trying to get something out of you or sometimes being shy or whatever it may be that they don't tell you whilst you're there. But the point is, you know, I shared that story because I felt like this is a heartfelt story. And I thought the moral that I wanted to push other people is like, don't wait for your boss to leave, right? Say thank you if they helped you whilst they're still there, or, you know, if it's your mentor or colleague or whatever it may be, right? Say thank you. And that got a lot of reaction, and people were tagging other people on that post and saying thank you. And so we had a few of those. So basically the most successful are actually the ones that would have a deep, authentic human connection to it. They would have a story to it. It's what makes us human, really, Boris. I think it's about stories that makes us, that show the humanity in us, that make us human, that catch the most. I mean, if you look on LinkedIn, there's a lot of that goes on, right? I mean, we are human beings, and ultimately, you know, an article, a report, data, yes, it's interesting, but, you know, ultimately we are going to more be into the storytelling piece.
Yeah, and of course, one newly emerging channel to put a human face to things is to be on a podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Well, a human voice, yes, but
the human voice at least. You've had your own podcast, Leaders in Supply Chain Logistics, for a number of years now, right? You started in 2017, so you have 68 episodes under your belt. Tell us about that a little bit. I mean, I've listened to a number of episodes. I recognize that we also have some shared guests. Björn van Jensen from Electrolux was on your podcast a while back. Sami Nafak from Ala was on our podcast first and on yours. So we share some common guests, but there's a very, very interesting lineup of guests that you have. And it's a similar format. So it's one-on-one interviews with senior level leaders in supply chain logistics companies. Anybody that stood out to you? Any episodes that people should start listening first to? What's your favorite episode, if there's such a thing?
I'm going to get myself into big trouble if I start. If I start favoring one on top of the other. But I would say that what we try to do, and actually even that podcast, when we started it, the intent was, and look, I mean, of course it helps to market, and of course it helps with our brand and all of that. That's nobody to say that it doesn't. But our intent was to share, and it still is to share and make it relevant and make it easy for people to listen to really top thought leaders in the industry, where otherwise it's tough to get to them because not everybody has access maybe to the conferences or the places where they would speak. So that was the intent, and also to make it as authentic as and real and practical as we could. So it worked out really well. And back to the point, what catches to people? I mean, I think that's why podcasts can be so popular, because it's a very intimate human-to-human type of a conversation. And where you kind of get a sense of that person, right? I mean, how is he like? How is she like? So we are very proud that we played a little bit of a part, and that, you know, that our Leaders in Supply Chain is fairly well received across the world. So we hope to continue to do that. And in terms of your question, which episode I prefer, and to be fair, I don't know if I have a preferred one, because we've tried to keep guests quite varied. So we've had, you know, from chief supply chain officers to chief procurement officers to CEOs of companies to board members of logistics companies to different heads of associations to professors to, you know, entrepreneurs that launched digital and technology related companies, software companies and supply chain. So we've really tried to keep a broad spectrum of guests, because the intent is to give different perspectives. So I would say that probably the best way is, whoever is, if somebody would like to check it out, is to go and see what are you most interested in at this moment, and then listen to those episodes or those companies or those executives first, because that's probably one approach to it.
Yeah, which, and again, it's a beautiful way of finding out the personal side of a person. You said, well, you can go to a speaking circuit or an event or a conference where someone's on stage, but typically these are PowerPoint presentations that are, 30 minutes long, and they're typically scripted, and it's not the same quality as hearing someone speak, especially when the podcast conversation isn't scripted. Just like this thing wasn't scripted, right? We generally agreed on what we were going to talk about, but everything else is sort of develops as it goes in a very authentic, organic way. So hopefully that gave people a good idea of what you're all about, and maybe you'll get pinged on LinkedIn when we hang up here today, like you already do anyways.
With pleasure, and absolutely, with pleasure.
What's the best way to connect with you? Obviously, on LinkedIn, people will find you there, Radu Palomario, and connect with you there.
Yes, so that's the number one. If anything, I think I'm a LinkedIn junkie and addicted to LinkedIn. I probably spend more time with LinkedIn than with my wife. She's not very thrilled about that, but yeah. I'm working on the balance, but yes, I can be found on LinkedIn easily. We also have a website, a blog, the podcast, different other channels. Google is our best friend. I think everybody's best friend, so you can track and trace anybody on Google. But I would say the easiest way to get to me is on LinkedIn.
Yeah. So, and I won't keep you any further. I want to make sure you go back to LinkedIn, or to your wife. Actually, it's evening there, so you should better go to your wife.
I'd better go to
LinkedIn for now. Radu, thank you very much for the conversation. I really enjoyed it. I hope our listeners did too. Have a great rest of the day, and people should check out your podcast as well. Yeah, it's good stuff. Thanks for being on the program, man.
My pleasure, Boris. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right, that was the BVL Digital Podcast episode with Radu Palomario from Alcott Global. I hope you found this both interesting and helpful. If so, please consider to give us a positive review on your favorite listening platform. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, your Boris Felgendreher.